You have to be a real dumb black man to burn up a white girl in the state of Mississippi.
Who set Jessica Chambers on fire 4 years ago? And is it the man who stood trial for her murder? Who shot Robert F. Kennedy 50 years ago? And is it the man who's now been denied parole a dozen times by the state of California? And who's the guest discussing Unspeakable Crime, the killing of Jessica Chambers, and Crime Town's The RFK tapes with me today? Is it the man who has his own pullout couch at Blotter HQ? That we have an answer for. Toby Ball is back to rule out Reddit herrings in The Blotter Presents, episode 68. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I am joined once again by Toby Ball. Hello, Toby.
Hey, it's been too long.
Yeah, it has been a shockingly long time. I just realized as I was reading the intro that it's episode 68, and we will be discussing one of the cataclysmic events of 1968, which kind of a cool coincidence, I guess. But probably Kismet. Meaningless in the grand scheme of things, like most coincidences in conspiracy theories.
As we will soon see.
Yes, indeed. But first, it's time for the Most Wanted section. We're leading off today with Oxygen's newest limited series. I feel like we got to come up with another name for these things. Like, it's not a mini series, and it's not a series, and it's not a prestige limited series, whatever it is. It's called Unspeakable Crime, The Killing of Jessica Chambers. It's a 5-part series that is dropping Saturday at 7 p.m. on Oxygen. That's Saturday the 15th. It is produced by Joe Berlinger, who also directed the first segment, and based on a BuzzFeed article that I'm pretty sure I read when it came out. Toby, were you familiar with this case at all?
I had no idea about any of this.
Okay. For those of you who, like Toby, were newbies to the case, here is the case file. This is taken from CNN's coverage of the indictment of Quentin Tellis. For 14 months, a town of 500 in northwest Mississippi grappled with the mysterious burning death of one of its daughters, Jessica Chambers, a 19-year-old who left her mother's house in pajama pants, reportedly to clean her car. She never returned. When police found her later the night of December 6, 2014, not far from her mother's Cortland home, her car was on fire and Chambers had burns over 98% of her body. She said something to a firefighter, authorities wouldn't say what, before she was rushed to a hospital where she died the next day. Cortland and Panola County residents didn't get all their answers Wednesday, but they learned that a man being held in Louisiana in connection with another homicide victim was indicted this week in Chambers' death. Not this actual week. The gruesome death of Jessica Chambers shines a light on the shifting, quote, bigotry of convenience of one small town. It interrogates the concept of the perfect victim, and it raises the question of whether it's possible to, quote, close a case once the post-serial internet has gotten its grubby little search strings on it. But does Unspeakable Crime do these things effectively? We've only seen the first hour and a half, but based on that, Toby, did you get more or less than what you were expecting from the show?
I guess it was better than I was worried it would be, quite honestly. A lot of the sort of pet peeves I have with these kinds of shows, this one largely avoided. Like, there weren't any, like, nauseating sort of recreations of things that were
true.
Clearly recreations and really serve no purpose to the overall story other than just to have some kind of visual for somebody to talk over. And then the interviews with people weren't conducted in, barns or empty diners or, in these sort of random locations. It seemed like that sort of level of cheese was not in place for this. you know, I've got some other kind of issues with just, and I can't tell, maybe we'll get to this, but I couldn't tell how much of it was sort of commenting on sort of the way we take a look at poor people, particularly poor Southerners, or was it just sort of exploiting that? I couldn't tell like what sort of degree of self-awareness they had about that aspect of the story.
Yeah, or what degree of self-awareness the subject had,
right?
As far as that goes. We'll get into that in a second. First, to your earlier point, I was not super concerned. Berlinger apparently has a couple of kids trying to get through college because I feel like he's doing a lot of these things, but it still is a seal of, if not approval for me, then at least more promising than oxygen or ID content might otherwise be without his name on it.
So what else has he done?
I'm sorry. He did the Vanished Gone, the Vanished Women of Ohio a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. He did something that you and I talked about, which actually may have been that. It's such a long list.
Yeah, no, point. I don't think I saw that one. I'll have to take a look into that.
Yeah, I actually meant to go through the like old rundown docs for this podcast and just search his name because I just feel like he's in it a lot. I think you and I actually talked about Paradise Lost the first time.
Right.
You were on the show.
That's right.
Lotus, many episodes ago. But he has done a lot more recent stuff. There's one that I just talked about and now I can't remember it. Listeners, I will hunt it down. It will be in the show notes. But early on, it was not promising because in the second clip, there's not only just the sort of standard stuff that every family member says about their lost loved one in 48 Hours or Dateline, but there's a commentary in the form of some twanging on the soundtrack. Here's clip two.
Jessica was a blonde-haired, cotton-top little girl. Jessica's smile would just light up a room when she came in.
Uh-huh. Like, you know, I understand that this is what everyone says because this is what everyone feels. Like, I'm not trying to clock grieving family members for this. I just am not always sure why it's left in the finished product, particularly since they really get into later this idea that Jessica was, you know, rebellious, was into drugs. To what extent is not really clear to me, at least based on this first episode. Fought with her mom a lot and was not always living at home. Quit the cheerleading squad. Like, she was not, you know, she was not this sunshiny, well-behaved girl all the time. And, you know, despite the fact that the show says explicitly, and the author of the BuzzFeed article says explicitly, and we'll hear that in a second, that one of the reasons this story took off is because of all the pictures of pint-size blonde Jessica in her cheerleading outfit and just that concept of, like, the blonde victim. That's part of the reason the story took off. But as always, it's quite a bit more complicated than that. So that clip was not promising. It turned it around, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, again, like when you first see it, you're like, oh, God, here we go. But, you know, looking, you know, having, like, after you watch like the first like 45 minutes or whatever, I think you can look back and it seemed more reminiscent of, did you ever see like River's Edge?
Yes.
That movie.
Yes.
So there are some scenes where there's people, I haven't seen it in years and years and years, probably decades, but I think there is a couple of scenes where a TV crew comes in and they show the kids talking about their murdered friend in a way that's totally informed by what they've seen people say about murdered people. So it's basically the same thing. She lit up the room. She was such a good friend or whatever. And that when you're watching the movie, you know that they're totally complicit in covering it up. Right. So it kind of, not that these people are complicit at all, but it does have that, it's just so socially programmed that when you're interviewed about like a dead kid, that's sort of what everybody says. Like nobody is like, well, yeah, you know, I guess he's all right. Or if they do, they don't put it up on the screen. So I thought it was an interesting choice, which again, I think once you kind of get through a little bit further, I think makes sense. And then I think it also maybe makes the sort of less stereotypical aspects of her life a little bit easier to take when you see like that she had other friends who don't seem like to be sort of living on sort of the gang end of the spectrum.
Well, and you know, they do interview her friends and they're like sitting around on bleachers and sort of saying that stereotypical stuff. That's like, there's no one that would have been mad at Jessica or wanted to kill her. Yeah. Like, well, that's often not how it works vis-a-vis women getting killed. Like it's not proceeding from a logical place. So there's that, but it's totally possible that that clip was like a part of a commentary on the second screen experience, because if anybody knows what it's like to have the story that you've told on film and then this parallel experience of the internet reacting to it, like Paradise Lost was not ground zero. I guess, you know, bad way to put it this week, but like ground two, like square two for that kind of thing, because of the Free the West Memphis 3 website and all of that stuff where, you know, and like, what's his face? Mark Byers and
right.
All the commentary about him and the internet being like, oh, no, he's the guy. And then the second installment comes out and the internet's like, oh, no, he's the man. And then the third installment comes out and everything is kind of, you know, called into question. But it's possible that that's sort of a larger comment on the like the secondary investigations and narratives that are happening. But this didn't get as into that part of it as I would have hoped, based on what we were seeing up top. This next clip is Katie J.M. Baker, who is shown hilariously. They did the like true crime show bingo card thing where they show her walking through the BuzzFeed newsroom in case we weren't like going to believe that that was right. Actually her. And here she is talking about what got her into the story. Clip three.
I came across Jessica's story really randomly, just looking online. It struck me immediately because being burned alive is such a horrific and personal way to die. And because she was this young, beautiful, blonde cheerleader, that's why her story took off. After Jessica was killed, this social media firestorm began. There was the Jessica Chambers mystery Facebook page. There were five or six others. It was almost as if people wanted to binge watch Jessica's murder investigation. Jessica was a teenager from a tiny town in Mississippi that most Americans haven't even heard of. But somehow these people from all over the country, these wannabe detectives, thought that they could investigate Jessica's murder more thoroughly than local law enforcement, even though they were just sitting on their couch in Canada or on a houseboat in Florida. They thought they could do it better.
Well, yeah, there's a lot to unpack in there, starting with the tiny blonde cheerleader part and then going into the, you know, Reddit to the rescue aspect.
Right. Not to mention that being burned alive is a very personal way to die, whatever that means.
Yeah. I mean, they're all pretty personal, except getting hit by lightning. I mean, I do think that the Baroque horror of that manner of death is, you know, that is part of it. But
it's mostly her.
Yeah.
It's mostly this cute little blonde cheerleader.
And possibly sort of, going back to what you were saying before, like this idea that, you know, the rural South is not competent to investigate something like this. Not that I'm saying that, but I think that's maybe the implication on the, you know, on some of these sleuthing pages.
Right. And I think, you know, I took a look, and so this is about an hour's drive from where the whole Curtis Flowers thing happened.
Okay.
From In the Dark season two. Cause I was kind of wondering, you know, how those related to each other. Cause there's also this like sort of long history, in the South of sort of the, you know, the sort of fear of white women being corrupted by, you know, African American men, and like her father even talks about it. He's like, I'm not a racist. You know,
we have that clip.
You got that? Okay. I'll hold off on that then. So there's that aspect of things. And then the whole Reddit thing. I mean, it kind of drives me insane in some ways. Most of my experience has been around the Adnan Syed case from Serial.
Right.
And because, you know, that was where Crime Writers On started. And, you know, I was sort of the one person who thought that Adnan might be guilty and everybody else thought they might be innocent. And it was just, you know, the Reddit pages are just so rabid about that stuff and feature this sort of, we think we're well informed, but in fact, it's sort of wild speculation kind of thing. And it's pretty crazy. And just the little clips they showed of what they were saying about that family, like the idea that you would lose a daughter in this absolutely horrific way. And then sort of part of the public reaction that you are privy to is like, you're a shitty mom. Maybe you did it, you know, all these kinds of, you know, assigning some level of blame to you rather than what, you know, you would hope would be more comforting, and which I think perhaps a different socioeconomic family people might have been more forthcoming with that, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I think there is absolutely this rush to judgment and also this feeling that because you're interested in the case, that interest gives you the right to insert yourself in it. Like you'll see some snippets from some of these Facebook, sleuthing groups, in the visual aids. Those are on social media. That's at Blotter Presents on both Twitter and Facebook. And there's also, a picture of the mom, Lisa, is talking about how painful it can be to interact with these internet sleuths and people who say they want justice for Jessica, but mostly are just being nosy. But that she continues to do it. Like, I think one of these groups banned her because she couldn't behave herself. So she's shown with one of these pages open, and she's also shown smoking, which is like definitely a signifier, I find, in at least in the true crime space, for like a lower socioeconomic rung of the ladder.
Right.
That it's like not a wink exactly, but you're supposed to assume certain things about people who are smoking on camera. And it's seldom positive things that you're supposed to assume, but people from these groups would call her like on the phone and be like, well, I heard that such and so, and she had, you know, lighter fluid was put up her nose and poured down her throat, and, you know.
Wait, what? Was that on the show, or did you see this elsewhere?
I saw it in both the article, the original BuzzFeed article, but it was mentioned in the first episode of the show that she was talking about people just calling her up and telling her stuff that she didn't know or that maybe wasn't true.
Right.
Which is not appropriate. Here's actually the next clip from Katie Baker, which is from right after the first clip, where she talks about the Heisenberging of this town and this investigation via the internet.
It wasn't just this horrific murder mystery. It was more a story to me about a small town and what happens when the internet descends on this town and causes problems.
Which I think the BuzzFeed article, which is from closer to the time of the murder. So you're not into this timeline that we're getting in the first episode of Unspeakable Crime, where an indictment has been handed down and a trial is underway. But in the first episode, I was hoping that we would get more of what we were teased in the opening montage about this issue. Like, you know, the crossing of lines by internet detectives, because I think that that's, I mean, I would kind of watch a whole series about that, about like just Redditors way overplaying their hands with this stuff.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I just have to assume that's going to come more later, because they tease a couple of things. They tease that, and they tease the sort of like, you know, racial tension aspect of things, which again, you know, hasn't really shown up in like a huge way.
Yeah, the quote that we opened with, we still haven't seen like in the show, like in its context in the show. But I just thought it was such a like direct, juicy way to put this, because really.
Right. Well, I think, you know, in this, you know, I'm again sort of getting outside the scope of this show, but that Missing Maura Murray podcast, like they started off wanting to do a thing about sort of the Reddit, I think specifically, but at least online obsession with the Maura Murray case.
Yeah.
And then got obsessed themselves, and it became something in my mind a lot less interesting, which was sort of investigating, you know, just without end, a case where it seems like the actual solution is pretty simple. But I thought that initial concept that they had of looking at these, the obsession that certain people have with, particularly with certain cases, and most of them again deal with white women. I thought that was a pretty interesting idea, which I wish they'd kind of pursued.
And sort of you see that also in the documentary about the Slender Man case.
Oh, yep. Yeah.
That, I mean, but there's a whole other, like, as always, there's never just that one axis of like this crime happened and then the internet got obsessed with it. Like there's always different motivations and reasons for that. And there's always different narrative axes that it's also existing along. And in that case, it was like, you know, teen and tween girls have like there's when you're in that bubble, things are very different than, you know, the relative sanity outside it, if memory serves. So there was that interesting aspect of the case. And of course, any case in which people feel like they can tell people, other people, some shit about how they're parenting tends to take off, as we saw here. But while we don't get into the racial tension aspect as much in the first segment, I was struck by Jessica's father's forthrightness on the subject of his own beliefs. He's just been talking in clip 5 before before we come in about how it feels to be blamed directly and indirectly for his daughter's death. And here is clip five.
I know in my heart I didn't hurt nobody. I'm not a racist. I got just as many black friends and Mexican friends I do white. But I don't believe in mixed relationships. I ain't nothing wrong with it. Don't get me wrong. They more than welcome to come to my house anytime, but that's just the way I feel. You know, I was the way I was growed up. I don't believe in that.
So there's that aspect. This is nothing that I have not heard from Southern in-laws, honestly.
Right.
This, you know, I have friends of color, but yeah, there's always the but.
Right, exactly.
But I was struck by how forthright he was about that, despite having been raked over every coal between here and Mississippi for expressing these sentiments quite a bit less gently.
He's a strange character, I think. I mean, it's all about him. Like one of the things I wrote down is when he talks about like how he'd like to find the guy who killed his daughter, and he wouldn't, you know, I can't remember exactly. He says something about he'd want to kill him, but then, well, maybe he wouldn't kill him. But then he says that he wishes that he could feel the pain that he caused me. So it's not like about like killing his daughter or the pain that he caused my daughter by burning her alive. It's the pain that he's caused me. Like the suffering I've had to go through as her father makes me want to kill him. It just seems like such an odd thing. And then as I noticed, it's always sort of coming back to him rather than what happened to his daughter.
Well, and we have another clip from him where they're all sitting around a picnic table, sort of the family, a couple of days before Quentin Tellis's trial starts. And this town is small enough, like her parents divorced when she was bitty, but he lives like across the street. The dad lives across the street from the mom when he's, you know, when he wasn't in the penitentiary. And I believe the Tellises live like at the end of the street. So there's all of that, like that this town literally is like, you know, everybody, you've always known everybody, and everybody knows everything about your business, whether you think they do or not. But then there's this performative moment that he has that you're right. It is very much about how Jessica's death and the ensuing investigation have not inconvenienced him, but put a spotlight on him that he says he doesn't want, but at the same time seems to relish. Here's clip six.
You know, they live that close. You go straight to the end of the road, you're dead into the house.
I mean, it gets hard to know when they live right there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because it's a constant reminder.
Sure is. So many people, you know, they think, man, damn, Ben, why ain't you killed that guy yet, you know?
Yeah.
How can I get to him to kill him? I ain't going to say I wouldn't kill him if I get my hands on him, you know? If you kill my dog, I'm going to kill your dog and cat. You do something to me, I'm going to do something back to you.
I mean, these clips taken together, it's like, on the one hand, it's a bit startling to hear people just put it out there like that. But on the other hand, I guess it's not. Like, I wonder if like 18 months in Trump's America has not.
Right. Well, I'm sure he'd be like, well, I guess I ain't PC enough for you.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and there is, I meant to mention when they're, you know, in this scene, they make sure to sort of, the camera makes sure to linger on the fried chicken and the ranch dressing.
Yeah.
Because I guess we're supposed to conclude something from that. I merely became hungry. He is a strange character, and I wonder where the, like, what the arc is going to do in future episodes.
He reminds me a little bit of that guy Tyler from S-Town, who I feel like isn't really savvy enough to realize that what he, the things that he says are like sort of outside the mainstream of who the audience for the show is going to be. And that he's not going to come off the way like he feels like he's going to come off.
Yeah.
So, and I, you know,
I had him as, I love that how many references to other properties were weaving in here, because I actually had him as the Mark Byers of this, possibly. Yeah. That you're like, I don't care for your worldview necessarily, but I also don't, like, I don't think he's responsible, but I wonder if he's not this, like, gonna turn out to be this, like, accidental Virgil of some kind in this narrative.
Yeah, I mean, that is an interesting, like, what does it mean that, you know, we're talking about this and we're just pulling in all these things that it reminds us of. And does that mean it's like, is that a good sign or a bad sign? Is he trying to sort of wedge this story into a narrative that we're all kind of used to? Or has he picked a situation that really reflects these broader themes in sort of the true crime, you know, Southern Gothic,
yeah,
type of story. I'm not sure.
Or maybe it's just that, you know, there's always that, like, because it's Berlinger, I think Paradise Lost is like, even if you're not aware that it's present, it's like a small ticker at the bottom of at least my experience of watching anything else he does.
Right.
But there's also, like, this is the same, like, Northwest Mississippi is not far from Arkansas. I mean, I guess it's a sort of across the state from West Memphis, which is on the, that's on the eastern side. It doesn't matter. There, I think there is also at this, you know, point in American history, a preoccupation, at least on my part, but I think on the part of a lot of people who look at crime stories or analyze crime stories and are trying to find like a larger meaning in how and why we consume them and why we consume so much of them, that this part of the South, like the Southern part of it, is compelling for reasons that we may not understand. That was really not clear, but I think the Southern Gothic aspect of it is key. And I'm just not sure how yet.
Yeah. No, it's interesting.
Because I think a lot of people who, you know, we consume a lot of true crime, we think about it, but we're able to, like, distance ourselves a little bit from the trashier aspects. And then, you know, here they are. And what are we supposed to think of certain things that the show chooses to underline about the size of this town, the, you know, politics and beliefs and bigotries of its inhabitants, so on and so forth. So I don't know.
Yeah, they kind of introduce the town now that you mention it, where it's like they're describing like every town in the South, where it's, you know, on Friday night, you know, Saturday you go to the football games, do your thing. Sunday morning you wake up and go to church. But then later, I get, maybe it's the cop who says that, you know, they have this drug problem and it's gang infested. And I'm like, you only got like 500 people. Like, I think you could have like 10 gang members and feel like you're gang infested.
Well, and you would be infested.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. I think they are maybe trying to draw like larger, or like not parallels, but I think they're trying to like extrapolate about an entire region possibly, which doesn't really work. But then once again, that the relationship of this case and these specific people to the internet, which I think kind of flattens the globe out a little bit, for lack of a better term, that, you know, it is a global village, as we used to say 20 years ago. And everyone does sort of have access to a lot of different information, but that can have a dark side, as in people inserting themselves into this case and like calling the parents at home and being like, did you know this horrible thing about your daughter's demise?
Right.
But perhaps certain more enlightened cosmopolitan attitudes about marriage amongst the races have apparently not come the other way into Cortland, or at least the brain of Ben Chambers. So I think I am going to keep watching this, because I'm interested to see what, like, I'm kind of interested to see how everything happens next, because I could just Google and right. see where the case is, but I didn't, which is a testament to it's holding my interest.
Right. I first have to find out if we get oxygen, if that's what it's on.
Yeah, you probably do.
We probably do.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think it's, I think it's, you know, it's a cut above like the Discovery ID or whatever it's called, or Dateline, I think. I mean, it's, at least so far, it seems like it's promising. So I might check it out. Depends on what else is going on.
Yeah. They do get into, they sort of develop this Quentin Tellis guy as a suspect, and then they find him, I believe, in a Louisiana jail, because I think he had already been
suspect.
Convicted of using another murder victim's credit card, but they weren't able to convict him of that murder, just of him right. taking her debit card. Which they had him that, dead to rights on that, I think.
Didn't that happen after?
Yes.
And that was how they came up with him like 14 months later or whatever.
Or I think they finally found her keys and his DNA was on the keys. And there's a lot of gaps in that case, but apparently not for a Panola County grand jury. And here's the DA running down his theory of the case in our last clip in this section.
What I suspect happened is something occurred at Quentin's house when they were in the car together, that he felt like he probably had killed her and had to get her away from his house. He drives the car down the road. He takes the keys, throws the keys down along the way back to his house. I believe that's Quentin getting the gasoline. He drives back to the scene, douses the car and Jessica with gas, sets it on fire.
I like this. It all makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've got all the prep work done.
We just need to finalize our game plan.
We got our week set out for us.
We ain't done this much work in years.
I guess I should have cut that last bit off, but I just thought it was not funny.
I like where he goes,
I mean, I guess that's a workable theory of the crime. I believe the timeline with Quentin and Jessica's relationship is that he had just gotten out of prison for something else, like a month before she died or 2 months or something like that. And they started hanging out, and then she died and he deleted all her info off his phone. And then his DNA was on her keys. But I mean, there's just like miles and miles of circumstance before you get to hard evidence of anything. So,
right.
Yeah. I'm interested to see what develops. And like I said, it's usually a testament to show's ability to hold my interest that I don't just like look at the timeline and be like, oh, well, I could just find out on the internet what happened.
Right.
So I did not do that. I think I will keep watching this at least for a couple of episodes to see if they push a little harder on some of the issues that they kind of implied that they were going to up top. But yeah, as Toby says, it's definitely a cut above what I think we've all started to think of as standard oxygen and ID fare. But we'll see. I think there might be some classist commentary in there that they're not even aware that they're making that is not helpful, but anything that puts you in mind of all of these other properties, maybe not, maybe not the Maura Murray podcast, but, you know, RIP that documentary though, man. I wish they just made that and gone on their way.
Yeah. Yeah. But I, you know, they're so popular. I think, it's going to be tough to put that genie back in the bottle.
Yeah. That, that sweet, sweet crack of high download numbers. I get it. Let's move on. In today's cold case section, we are talking about the RFK tapes, a podcast that I think actually just wound up last week with a live show at the Bell House in Brooklyn. Unsurprisingly, this podcast concerns itself with the murder of Robert F. Kennedy, and here's the case file from the podcast's iTunes page. When Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated in 1968, a lone gunman was captured at the scene, revolver in hand. It seemed like an open and shut case, so why did the police keep evidence hidden away for decades? Over 10 episodes, hosts Zach Stewart Pontier of Crimetown and Bill Klaber, the author of Shadow Play, combed through previously secret police tapes and tracked down the people who were there to investigate troubling questions about one of the most significant crimes in American history. Toby, you wanted to talk about this, so do you want to give us a little background on what inspired you to bring this to the cold case table?
I thought it was, first of all, I think the summary they have is not very accurate, although I think they have to put it that way in order to have people like go through the entire series to get to the end. The way it starts off is that this guy, Zach, has, you know, his sort of introduction to conspiracy theories was hearing a cassette tape of Bill Klaber kind of running through, like why he thought the RFK assassination wasn't just Sirhan by himself. And I guess Zach Stewart Pontier heard this when he was like 10 and didn't really get it, but thought it was kind of cool.
Yeah, Klaber was pitching a feature, I believe, to Zach's dad, who was the editor-in-chief of the local paper. Yeah.
So basically the way the first, you know, two-thirds to three-quarters of the podcast goes is that Zach goes to see Bill Klaber, and then basically Bill Klaber becomes like a co-host, and they start going through what they see as being sort of the troubling aspects of the assassination and the post-assassination investigation that would point towards there being more than just Sirhan, and possibly even like a sort of cover up by the LA police. And it kind of hinges upon a few pieces of evidence or facts. One of which is that Kennedy was shot from behind and Sirhan was in front of him in the little area in which he was killed. That there appear to be, I think he had like a gun that could shoot 7 shots, and there were 9, you know, there were 9, like, there's evidence of 9 bullets.
Right.
And then there's a strange story of this woman in a polka dot dress, like running out and saying, we shot him, or we killed him. And they're like, and somebody said, who? And she said, Robert F. Kennedy, and then ran off into the night. So it's sort of these three things are like very hard to reconcile with this idea that Sirhan did it himself.
Who has claimed from the beginning that he doesn't remember anything, and initially in the police interrogation would not even give his name and was sort of acting like he didn't remember that either, which both your names are the same, bro. That's not a viable.
it's one third as hard for you as everybody else.
exactly.
So they talk to, and part of it revolves around this guy, Allard Lowenstein, who was a congressman who was, you know, it's a little bit hard to tell exactly what his relationship was with Bobby Kennedy, but you know, they were friends at some level, and Lowenstein's you know, affiliation was sort of sought by both Kennedy and I think Humphrey. Am I getting that wrong?
No, it's not McGovern. It's McCarthy.
McCarthy. Okay. Yeah. So he's, you know, so he's got a little bit of heft, but he, after the assassination, like a few years after, sort of gets a bee in his bonnet that there was more going on. And then he's sort of killed by a former staffer, which of course gets all the conspiracy people's, you know, radars on full.
But what, that was a great, just in terms of like narrative build, that was a great plot twist. Like, I actually yelled the words plot twist while I was listening to it and folding laundry, and I frightened a cat.
Oh, well, there you go. So, but what I thought was most interesting about it is, you know, towards the end, we get introduced to a second kind of conspiracy theory guy, who's this guy, Dan Moldea. And we were listening to this as we were driving back from Nova Scotia, and we were in New Brunswick. And my kids were in the back seat, and they were sort of listening to music and reading. But every once in a while, they'd kind of like take off their headphones, and they'd hear a little bit of it. And they were both like, "Who is that guy? Like, what? Who is this jerk?" Because this guy Moldea is pretty full of himself and thinks he's a pretty tough guy.
Yeah.
But what I thought was really interesting about the whole series was that basically Moldea writes a book. He writes like 23 chapters.
Yeah, he's like 29/30 of the way to finishing this book about how, like, this security guard who was like anti-Kennedy, obviously was the one who actually shot him. And then he, after visiting Sirhan in jail, is like, I think if you confront the idea that he is lying and has been lying all along, that everything then falls into place, and then he and Klaber diverge. So,
right, and he's like, well, maybe Sirhan did do it. And then, so he's like, well, then you have to go back and sort of take a look at what are sort of the foundations of my believing there were a conspiracy. And then he just takes them all apart, and you see that these little anomalous things that seem like they pointed toward a conspiracy, when all put together, when you examine each one individually, turns out to be a whole lot of nothing. So,
yeah,
you know, in the end, and I didn't listen to the live thing because I saw some stuff on social media saying that it was a complete debacle, and I didn't want to ruin my happy feelings about it. But I just thought it was, you know, I thought it was unusual. Like, it's always so, it's such a temptation to say, to leave it with the, like, yeah, this is a messed up conspiracy and we still don't know or whatever. And I thought what was cool about this show is it was like they went through the whole conspiracy. They get you kind of inside the head, inside sort of the mind of what it's like to really sort of buy into it and see it as being really, really problematic. And then they show you how it gets debunked in like very, like, so for instance, one of the things is there's these, so they have these double doors with like a sort of a little tiny piece of wall running in between them, and it's got these dents, and somebody had circled them and said they were bullet holes and put their badge number by the circle. And then, so this thing was taken away as evidence, and the LA police said that it was, you know, most likely made by people bumping into it with trays. And then for some reason they burned it. So people are like, why did you destroy the evidence? Including Vincent Bugliosi of Helter Skelter fame.
Oh, yeah.
And but then it turns out, but they have a picture of it, and the guy tracks down the guy with the badge number, thinking that he's some criminologist or crime scene investigator. And it turns out he's just a patrolman, and that he almost definitely just misinterpreted what he saw and sort of the hecticness of what was going on. He just saw something weird, circled it. And then from then on, it became in some people's minds bullet holes, when in fact it probably was just dents.
I just was listening to this episode like at lunch today, right before we recorded this. And he was a like motorcycle cop, highway patrol. And his widow was like, oh no, he wasn't a criminologist. And you just hear like a wah, wah. Like,
yeah.
I mean,
And like every single thing kind of comes out to that same, like the girl in the polka dot dress. Like, it turns out this whole thing was based on one person's like somewhat hazy recollection. And it just, on the face of it, sounds ridiculous. Like, if I was an assassin, I wouldn't run out of the place and just be like, I killed him, I killed him. And people be like, who? I'd be like, that guy, I killed him. And
well,
then like
or
run
wear
off.
Something less noticeable
than a polka dot. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you're,
people would notice me in a polka dot dress. Definitely.
I've always said that about you, Toby.
Yes.
Well, I have always been kind of not obsessed, let's say preoccupied with Robert Kennedy, because of this feeling I have that of all the things that were happening in 1968, and there were many, and they were mostly scary and disorienting. And, you know, I was not around. I was still an egg. But my dad frequently cites 1968 as the last time the country felt this fucked up, compared to now. But it's always struck me that this particular event was some kind of dividing line, or there was some kind of fork in the road, and this was when it was no longer possible to get off the road that the country was on after his death. And I am obsessed with the oral history of the experience of taking his funeral train, which was done by George Plimpton and Gene Stein, and is not in print anymore, which is really a shame. They should really bring it back. Look for it on eBay. It is beautiful and sad, and especially sort of at this time of year, I find myself thinking about it a lot, and the way that public communal grief was 50 years ago versus today. But I really liked what the RFK tapes did in that vein. The podcast is called The RFK Tapes and not Who Killed RFK. And I think that's significant, because they do an excellent job of letting all of this material that they have, some of which has never been heard before, speak for itself. And they don't get in the way of it or try to interpret it for you. They sort of, like Zach and Bill Klaber, kind of give you context and then get out of the way. The first episode, they're not as great about this. In clip 8, they're kind of explaining some things that to me felt overexplained, but I am an oldster, so let's play that, and then Toby, maybe you can weigh in.
When Senator Robert F. Kennedy was shot at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, minutes after winning the 1968 California Democratic primary, Dallas was on everyone's mind. Dallas was where Bobby's older brother, President John F. Kennedy, had been assassinated less than 5 years earlier. There, a sloppy investigation and the murder of the only suspect in the case had left public doubts and swirling conspiracy theories about who had really killed JFK. And so, after RFK was shot, in the early morning hours of June 5th, 1968...
The date is June 4th, 1968.
They recorded everything.
Excuse me, Jack, it's June 5th.
Was this too much explaining? Or is that necessary for people who are not, like me, 45 years old and have seen JFK 28 times?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess they didn't take... so long in it. But
yeah, no, they didn't. And it
you're...
wasn't condescending or anything. It was just like, right. Dallas, in case you've forgotten who the Kennedys are, like, who the fuck
right.
needs to be told this? Maybe some people do. I don't know.
It's an interesting, well, I think the point of the LAPD, and I don't know what their reputation was in 68, but I imagine it was probably not that great, given that it seems to have never been that great.
Yeah.
But that they're like, this is like time for some serious ass covering, so we're just going to record everything. Like, I can see that. Did you read the book Dallas 1963? Have you ever seen that?
No.
It's pretty cool. It's I'm not gonna remember who wrote it, but it's basically about what like an absolute like John Birch style right wing place Dallas was.
Oh yeah.
In the year leading up to it, it goes into quite a bit of detail and about how people like who are kind of in the know are like, why the hell is Kennedy going there?
Yeah,
like,
this was also in. This was also in Manchester's The Death of a President, that he just sort of goes very carefully through the week before and the week after the assassination of JFK. And he
yeah.
definitely, like, it was hardcore, like, school children applauding when they heard about the murder kind of place.
Yeah.
Like, he was not popular. It's a huge understatement. But yeah, I'll check out that book for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I can't remember exactly why I read it. I must have read a review or something, but I read it and thought it was super interesting. Yeah. So I think it's a good, I mean, I guess it's good that they did that just for this, for this podcast, because there's plenty of sound. And I think the Allard Lowenstein stuff is also interesting, both in getting, you know, his sort of viewpoint on Bobby Kennedy and like why he invested so much sort of emotionally and sort of his vision about what the country could be was really wrapped up with Bobby Kennedy becoming president, and then sort of the personal devastation he felt when Kennedy was assassinated.
And I think that was, you know, when I first took the note about that clip, I was like a little annoyed by it. Like, really? We're Kennedy splaining? But,
right.
You know, I think that we're like, I think for younger people, it's not necessarily this constant of American life. These,
right.
You know, these like secular saints that the Kennedys are for a certain generation. I mean, not everyone in that generation, but I think it's much, it's not safe to presume that everyone is as familiar with those facts. Here's a fact that I had forgotten about the actual, the crowd at the Ambassador Hotel, which is that literally everyone famous apparently was in it. Here's clip 9.
Kennedy has been shot and possibly shot in the head.
The senator slumped to the ground as Kennedy supporters pounced on the shooter.
He still has the gun. The gun is pointed at me right at this moment. Get the gun. Get the gun. Get the gun.
George Plimpton, P-L-I-M-P-T-O-N.
George Plimpton, the famous writer, explains to the cops how he grabbed the gunman.
I grabbed an arm that had the gun in it and bent him over this steam table here.
His hand is frozen. Take a hold of his thumb and break it if you have to. Get his thumb.
Other persons or other people that grabbed him also?
Yeah, Rosie Grant then came and helped. Rafer Johnson then came and helped.
That's it, Rafer. Get it. Get the gun, Rafer.
I mean, I think I think that's a really good, it gives a really good sense of the chaos. I would also recommend for this, I think Carrie Kennedy. Robert and Ethel had so many kids and named enough of them with K names that it could be Kathleen or Kick or someone. I believe it was Carrie Kennedy who made a documentary about her mom, Ethel, a few years ago that got into the scene a little bit, at which Carrie was technically present because Ethel was pregnant with her at the time. But it's actually more evocative just hearing it somehow than seeing it, because I feel like we've all seen this footage a million times, but then hearing it only and not really being able to see, I mean, not being able to see at all anything that's going on, I think gets closer to the confusion that reigned at the time. So that's a really good use of that audio. And just generally, they have a really good curation sense of what to play, how much to explain. Here's an Allard Lowenstein clip, actually, off your earlier comment, that, you know, here's this Camelot guy that you kind of feel like this was a congressman, and how insane could he be? And it's not until later that you really realize, like, you may have gotten carried away along with one of the hosts in terms of, like, making all these facts into something more than weird coincidences. Anyway, here's clip 10.
The tripwire that made me feel that I should look at things was precisely the fact that if there was someone in the highest, most sacred office willing to use power so improperly on someone as obscure as I, what made me think that there weren't other people in less high office willing to use power improperly against major figures? And in that event, don't I owe it to look at what may have occurred in the case of the assassination?
Lowenstein looked at how Nixon had abused his power, and it raised his suspicions into the murder of his old friend, Robert Kennedy.
The context there is that Allard Lowenstein had showed up on Nixon's enemies list, and he kind of extrapolated from that, like, if my lowly ass was on his enemies list, then why wouldn't RFK have been on a much more powerful person's enemies list? And also, they make the point several times that nobody wanted Robert to become president, because then they'd really find out what happened to JFK. So,
yeah,
I mean, there's... It's really well done, I think, because they, like you said, they are going down this road, like, we're all going down this road together with the hosts and getting all this information in a certain order at the same time. And then we're brought back around. I actually haven't listened to the 10th and final episode proper, but I, like, and I'll get to it, but I really liked the way they did this, that you're not, I don't know, like, they're playing fair with the narrative. They're not really holding anything back at any particular time, I don't think. Like, they're not cheating it to create suspense that doesn't exist, but it's a really interesting commentary on the, you know, humanity's need to resolve these things, which I guess you could say parallels the property we were talking about in the first part of the podcast. Mm-hmm. And the fact that there's always information that it doesn't fit, no matter what theory you go with. That's just, you know, John Douglas, the FBI profiler, said this a bunch of times. Sometimes that, like, the pineapple might have nothing to do with anything. In John Bennett's case, like, you know, not everything fits neatly in to a narrative, which is part of why we make narrative. So I thought this was a really effective on the, you know, on its own level, but also that meta level.
The one thing that was kind of weird that seemed unresolved to me at the end, in which they kind of touch on and then let drop, is they do spend a little bit of time about, like, this idea about self hypnosis and Rosicrucianism. Oh, yeah. And then they have, like, this weird little clip of some guy, like, saying that he saw Sirhan Sirhan and something about him reminded him of Rosicrucianism. And I was like, what, where is this going? And then it never went anywhere else. They just kind of dropped it right there. But that was very odd. Now, And that's, you know, obviously Rosicrucians are like big conspiracy theory. You know, it's like the Masons and all those other secret societies.
Well, they wish. I mean, it's like mail order masonry. But
is that, I don't know a ton about them, but yeah. I just know that they pop up every once in a while. And it's just like, huh? Anyway, yeah. No, I thought it was really good. I mean, I was a little worried at the beginning when Bill Klaber was such a part of it. Because I didn't, you know, again, I think if you're looking for tiny little bits of inconsistencies and thinking that you can weave a larger narrative out of it, I think that's a dangerous road. I guess sometimes it can be, uncover some truths and stuff, but I think that if you're going about it that way, like the hurdle that you have to get over has got to be pretty high, you know, if it's just weaving like weird little things like that together. But then I think as a whole package, I think it was a pretty interesting look at like three or four different issues.
Yeah.
Conspiracy being one of them.
Well, the drive, especially when it comes to the Kennedy family, to assign sort of a larger conspiracy to, or assign blame to a larger conspiracy instead of single madmen. The fact that a lot of these conspiracy theories started coming up in the mid 70s when everyone was feeling kind of like hungover by Watergate, the human instinct, especially if you're grieving a friend, to put everything into a single frame that seems to create a picture that makes sense, even though, you know, the man was killed at the age of 42, and it, like, there's really no sense to that. It just is. But they didn't really underline any of that stuff. They didn't try to get too, cute with it. They just were like, this is really a lot of good evocative material, and we're going to put it together in a evocative, well-paced way. And they did. I am interested to know in what manner, the debacling, what form the debacling took at this live show. I guess I'll have to listen to it myself and report back.
It's some people tweeted at me, but it's not going to make for great podcast listening for me to recount these tweets.
Right. Well, yeah. Listeners, if you have heard it and can report, let us know. I'll be listening to it probably by the time you're hearing this. And we can talk about it on Twitter. Again, that's @BlotterPresents. I do have one more clip. Even if I learned nothing else from listening to this podcast, which I did, and I'm glad I did it. But I learned, which I don't think I knew, what Vincent Bugliosi sounds like. I may have been happier not knowing he sounded like this. Here he is in our final clip.
Here in Los Angeles, the theory that two guns were used in the assassination of Senator Robert Kennedy was raised again today by attorney Vincent Bugliosi.
The more I get into this case, the more I see things that I do not like. I think you can draw certain inferences from that. I've never seen so far, I have not seen anything that I do like.
I would also love to hear from anyone who got all the way through what my husband calls to this day the Book of Death. It is literally a cube, and it came with the CD-ROM. It is Vincent Bugliosi's definitive unpacking of the JFK assassination. I love Bugliosi, may he rest, but I didn't expect him to sound like a cartoon character.
Yeah.
Toby, where else can listeners find you and your works and days?
They can find me on Twitter at TobyBallNH, and you can find me, well, it's usually Fridays on Crime Writers On, but since the new Serial season's dropped, we are going to be, I think, dropping on Mondays, which will allow us time to respond to the Thursdays Serial and then have an episode 4 days later, which is probably more than you needed to know. And we also have a Patreon book club called Balls Deep Dive, which next month is going to feature Sarah.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, we're doing Monster of Florence.
Oh, yeah.
So I was about to say, I was going to send you an email this week, but I'll just mention it to you now.
Okay,
hope you've read
great.
It. I just started it. I listened to it twice on audio, which is an experience in and of itself.
Yes, it was my initial experience with the picnicking friends of the Monster of Florence. I think I'm just going to read it this time.
Yes, that's what I'm doing now.
Oh, man. All right, so yeah, I'm talking about the Monster of Florence. Good for me. We will also be talking about Serial Season 3 on The Blotter Presents in a couple of weeks. Before we do that, Jeb Lund will join us to talk about number 2, It Tries Harder, Season 2 of American Vandal. Until then, got a tip for The Blotter Presents? Find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. You can email me at bunting@the-blotter.com, and you can become an official Blotter tipster at our Patreon page, patreon.com/blotterpresents. If you like the podcast, tell a friend and rate it on iTunes. If you don't like the podcast, shut it. My guest has been Toby Ball, and as he said, he's on Twitter at TobyBallNH. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.